morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this first day of October. All things political is heating up as we approach the presidential election and many other important elections as well. We'll have two guests with us for All Things Political this hour to talk about a variety of issues. The presidential candidates, I understand, are just completely focused on the debate, first debate, which will take place this Wednesday in Denver. We'll talk about that debate. We will look at polls, which show that Governor Romney is trailing in every poll in swing states. What do our guests this hour think about those polls? Are they accurate or are they not? We'll look at Senate races as well, and we will touch on a few of the issues that the Supreme Court will be dealing with. Hour number two of our program today is all Supreme Court with Jeffrey Toobin, who has a new book, and fascinating it is. It is titled The Oath, The Obama White House and the Supreme Court. Both hours, you are welcome to join our conversation. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. We'd like to hear from you as these contests are soon to be decided. We have two guests with us. We will start this hour with Stephen Toma. He is senior White House correspondent and the government and politics editor for McClatchy Newspapers. He has some Midwest roots. Before he came to Washington, he worked for the Pioneer Press in Minnesota and also worked in Fort Wayne in Indiana and the City News Bureau in Chicago. Stephen, thank you very much for being with us.
Good morning. It's my pleasure.
Yeah, nice to have you here. I imagine, I've been thinking about Obama and Romney in debate preparation. This is intense. I understand for the next 2 days, this is about all they're doing.
They stand in a room at podiums that look exactly like the podiums they'll use in the debates. They stand the exact distance apart that it is set on the stage. And their opponent, the stand-in for their opponent, will fire as hostile a questions and comments as they can for 90 minutes. Yeah, it gets very intense.
Oh, that sounds like fun. Hostile questions for the whole day, today and tomorrow.
I'm sorry?
It must be exhausting to have hostile questions thrown at you for 2 days in a row.
Well, especially if, like most of these politicians do, they haven't had enough hostile questions thrown at them by people like you and me. Because they don't take as many questions from the press as they used to. They're not as good at it as they used to be. Yeah, it can be a little unnerving to them to get tough questions 8, 10, 12 hours a day.
So as you would be looking at how Obama is preparing, where would you say his advisor is saying Romney is vulnerable, and where would Romney say that Obama is vulnerable?
Well, clearly they're going to look at the same things we're going to look at in terms of, like, for instance, let's say you're in the president's camp today. You're going to say Mitt Romney is vulnerable on a few major issues. And remember, the first debate is domestic policy. So he's going to be vulnerable on his wealth, or the notion that he is too friendly to the wealthy and not as friendly as he should be to the poor or the working class. That 47% video that came out 2 weeks ago from a fundraiser, that's a vulnerability for Mitt Romney. Look for the president to expose that or kind of rub the salt of that wound whenever he can, as he does in television advertisements.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to talk about Mitt Romney's tax policies because they think that it is a vulnerability that Mitt Romney wants to cut taxes, particularly for people at the high end of incomes. Now, the polling actually suggests it's been kind of divided and a little back and forth, but the Obama people think that's definitely a vulnerability. And they're probably going to try to introduce the notion that Mitt Romney is vulnerable on flip-flopping. It was a big issue in the primary campaign where the Republicans complained about it from the other side. But I think the Obama people also think it's a vulnerability, that no one can really be sure where Mitt Romney stands on some of these big economic questions. And finally, the question of Bain Capital and what Bain Capital did, the investment firm that Mitt Romney headed, and what it did in terms of laying people off or buying or selling companies that led to layoffs even later, they'll think that's a vulnerability. On the other side, Barack Obama's vulnerability is pretty evident. It's the economy. It's 8% unemployment for 43 straight months, the longest since the 1930s. It's the fact that poverty has gone up since the recession ended, more than it did during the recession, that average incomes of the middle class have gone down more since the end of the recession than they did during the recession. It's the basic economic track record of the president is his vulnerability.
The polls keep pointing to this likability factor. Is that just a piece of extraneous polling, or is that important? Because Romney seems to be having problems. Some are saying that he needs to show us that he's a likable person. Does that make any difference?
Yeah, sure, it makes a difference. And it's the largest gap of any polling between Barack Obama and Mitt Romney. I think there's about a 40-point gap in the likability or personal favorability. Here it makes a difference. You wouldn't hire someone, even if they came into your office and you were hiring someone, and they had a great resume and they had all the right answers, but you just couldn't stand the guy.
Right.
It's the American people are hiring a president for the next 4 years. They got to like him. The second part of that, though, is how it tracks with the overall storyline. If, for instance, one of them comes off as cold and aloof, and the storyline that's taking hold is that person is a little cold, let's say, to the middle class or to the poor or the working class, in the case of Mitt Romney, that's not going to help that. That's going to reinforce the negatives, and vice versa. You know, Barack Obama actually had the same problem for a long time, that he did not connect well with people. People saw him as cold and aloof. He's only done better in comparison to Mitt Romney.
Mm-hmm. What do you make of polls that show that Governor Romney is trailing in every poll in swing states? So much is written about the fact that he needs a real game changer here. Do you trust those polls because there have been so many of them, or do you not?
I trust them, yes. I know this is a point of some debate, particularly from our conservative friends who think the polls are not right. I was watching a morning TV show this morning on the Fox network saying, well, obviously they're all wrong. We found the one poll that's right. It happens to be the poll that shows Mitt Romney ahead or neck and neck. I know many of these pollsters, particularly the Marist poll, who also polls for McClatchy. These are very good polls. They are as accurate as they can be for today, particularly when you take four or five or six showing roughly the same thing. As you know, in polling, there's a statistical margin of error that it's within 3 points or 4 points 95% of the time. So 5% of the time, 1 out of 20 is going to be wrong, just completely wrong. But if you throw that out and you just average the rest, it shows Mitt Romney is falling behind in these key states of Ohio and a little bit in Florida and definitely in Wisconsin and New Mexico and no, there's no doubt that these polls are right. The big question I think people raise is how many Democrats are polled and how many Republicans are polled. That's the complaint you hear, that they oversample Democrats or undersample Republicans. It's not a good complaint, and here's why. Party identification is not a demographic. It's not something you can take into account when you say, well, we got to make sure we have 51% women and 49% men, or we got to have a certain age group, or we have to have certain races or even religions. Party identification is simply something people say about themselves. Most people are not registered. In a lot of states now, it's a plurality of people are independents or unaffiliated voters. So how they tell a pollster they feel, whether they're Democrat or Republican, is just how they feel that day. So you can't wait a poll to say we've got to have exactly the right number of Democrats or Republicans.
Stephen Chilma is our guest, the first part of this hour for All Things Political, senior White House correspondent and government and politics editor from McClatchy Newspapers, and we're welcoming your calls. We'll take them in just one moment. Stephen, when you look historically, have there been other candidates, noteworthy candidates, who have been able to come from behind and pull it all off?
A lot of them. That's why, I mean, the fact that Barack Obama, and of course the best example is Ronald Reagan, who at the very end had been neck and neck with Jimmy Carter until the end of the 1980 campaign. And the debate 1 week before Election Day turned it, and within 1 week, Ronald Reagan won by a landslide. Definitely things could turn around. There are still factors that are unknown out there in the electorate and in governing, biggest one is actually a foreign policy question. Libya, we can talk about that later if you want.
Sure.
But definitely this could change. It's close. You know, when we say Barack Obama has, I say he has the edge. I wouldn't say he has a lead in these states. It's 4 or 5 points. One of the terms of art we use in reporting on polls is we say someone has a lead if they have twice the margin of error. If they have more than the margin of error but less than twice, we say they have the edge. And if it's within the margin of error, we just say it's neck and neck.
What do you?
He only has an edge. This isn't 8, 9, 10 point lead. This isn't insurmountable yet.
What do you make of this story out of Florida, which I noticed in the Times on Saturday, and now I hear more reporting on it today? Voting problems, election officials in 7 counties now telling state reelection officials about questionable voter registration forms filled out on behalf of the Republican Florida Party. Is this a story that has legs?
It certainly has legs in Florida, where, by the way, McClatchy publishes newspapers, so we're very interested in it. It also was happening in North Carolina, among the 5 states where it's been found, particularly because of one firm. Sure, it's very interesting. I mean, you know, these parties, as do candidates, often hire private firms to go out and sign people up, and sometimes these places hire either disreputable people or they hire young, overeager people, and they pay them per voter registration, and some of them go out and make up names. They sit on a corner curb and they just fill in a bunch of names, and it happens. I'm not sure it's nefarious, but it certainly is a problem.
2 phone calls momentarily. Our number is 800-486-8655. You're listening to the Ideas Network and all things political for this Monday, the 1st of October. This is the Ideas Network. Hour 2 of our program. It's delightful. We have him on the first Monday in October. Jeffrey Toobin will be our guest. He has a new book, The Oath, The Obama White House and the Supreme Court, in addition to talking about the cases that they will be looking at, the important cases of this term, which starts today. Fascinating information on Chief Justice John Roberts, on President Obama, on their past, and information on each of the justices. So that's coming up, hour 2. 2 phone calls now. Dave in Wanakee is our first caller for you. Stephen, hi, Dave.
Yes, hello. Forgive me for being cynical about Republicans' viewpoints, but it looks like it's all being set up by their think tanks that they're going to lose this upcoming election, not because people don't like their ideas, but because there was a big conspiracy by the media, first of all, to push these polls in the wrong direction. And then after they set up the, us, the foolish electorate, then there's going to be a massive voter fraud going on, for which they can never find people who actually committed voter fraud. But if you look at election fraud, they do that all the time. And then, you know, after they've lost, it'll have been some big conspiracy, so they have to push more laws to, you know, suppress voting.
Stephen.
I think there's definitely a lot of talk about this media conspiracy. Obviously, I don't think it's true, but I think you're right. I think there would be a lot of talk if Mitt Romney were to lose, that it was not a legitimate result, and that part of the reason may have been cooking the books on the polls. This is not new, of course. We saw this both in 2000 and 2004. From Democrats or liberals who thought that the Republicans stole the election in Florida, or that the Republicans in 2004 stole the election in Ohio. I still get an occasional email from someone saying that the 2004 result was not correct because an exit poll in Ohio had showed that Kerry was going to win, John Kerry, the Democrat. And everyone knows an exit poll is more accurate than the actual result, which we chuckle about in the office because we don't think that's true. But I think there's a second part, though, that's very interesting the caller raises, which is if the Republicans were to go on to lose this election, which is, by all accounts, an election they should have been able to win or should be able to win, given the economic situation, I think the Republican Party would probably have to go to the drawing board and say, why did we lose it? At least the people in Washington who might be a little more immune to this speculation about fraud or conspiracy, and say, what is it? Is it our message? Or was it simply the messenger? did we misplay our hand after the 2010 election, after we won that great victory? There's no doubt the party has a great opportunity to win the presidency, and if they don't, I see a lot of debates within the party about what to do.
And one final question on this Florida story. Does this story, the fraudulent Florida registration story, give support, as the Republicans have been pushing for voter ID in many states, or does it kind of fly in their face of your hypocrites?
Well, I wouldn't say hypocrites, but it certainly is ironic, given the number of Republicans who have been talking this year about what they think is rampant voter fraud. I say they think it's rampant voter fraud because there's no evidence that there's rampant voter fraud, and that one of the bigger examples this year we have a voter registration fraud, not exactly the same thing, but it comes from within their own party. Yeah, that's irony.
Yeah. Thanks, Dave, very much for the call. Larry in Beloit. Hi, Larry.
Yes. In regards to the voter fraud issue, I got three topics here. With all the illegal immigrants that's in this country, you're telling me that they're in this country without some type of fake ID and to have a fake ID to be able to vote. That's my first thing. Second is I do believe the press has been biased toward the Republican candidate. Like, for instance, when they talked about the embassy getting attacked in Libya. The first thing I seen on the CBS News was Mitt Romney's candidacy rather than talk about the episode that happened in Libya. And on these polls here, I'm seeing polls where Obama's as far ahead as 14 points. But then on other polls, I see that they're within 2 points of each other. So you can't tell me that all the majority of these polls are correct. I just don't buy that. I find that incredible.
Stephen.
Well, let's take them in reverse order. The polls, as I mentioned, it is a part of the statistics of polling that 1 out of 20 polls is going to be completely wrong. And I would say any poll that shows Barack Obama up 15 percentage points either nationally or in a battleground state is wrong. Yeah, throw it out. Disregard it. No doubt that poll is wrong. If that poll shows them a 15% in some place like a liberal state like Vermont, it's probably accurate. The best thing to do with the polls is average them. You know, there are a couple websites that do that. If you average them out, I think you get a much more accurate picture of what's going on. And I don't think there's any 15-point lead. I think it's much closer to 2 on average if you look at the average of the polls. On the second question, the question of the Libya story, fascinating story. First, it's just simply false. I'm sorry. No media outlet on the day of the Libya attack on the embassy reported the first story that Mitt Romney criticized. The first story was the attack on the embassy. The second or third story may well have been Mitt Romney, but it was not the first story. But the media focused a fair amount that first 24 hours on his criticism of Barack Obama. Since then, the mainstream media has broken virtually every single story about how the Barack Obama administration got the story wrong and continued to, including McClatchy and CBS and ABC and CNN. There's a lot of speculation that the media is not reporting. It's simply not true. I defy anyone to go back and look at the stories. The media has reported a lot about how the White House, particularly in the State Department, have gotten this story wrong. And the final issue, I have no idea if illegal immigrants have fake IDs and then also are able to vote. I assume that's possible. I don't know anything about it.
Let's talk a little bit more about Libya. Some have said that the president is now vulnerable on foreign policy and that he kind of kept his eyes and ears off what was going on the ground and a resurgence of terrorism, interest in terrorism action in the Middle East. Thus, Libya happened, and perhaps it should not have. I would imagine that's going to come up in the foreign policy debates. But is he vulnerable on this issue?
Absolutely he's vulnerable on this issue. This was a significant and jarring attack on U.S. property and U.S. lives on 9/11. And it was terrorism. That by itself is a question that everyone has to, particularly the press, have to ask the president, and we have been asking it for 2 straight weeks and reporting on it.
Mm-hmm.
But the second part of that is the fact that the administration went out forcefully and said, no, it wasn't our fault. It wasn't anything to do with terrorism or 9/11. It was all having to do with a reaction to this video. Suggests that they were trying to get the American people to look the other direction. And if that turns out to be true, the president would be not only vulnerable politically, but should be questioned repeatedly about that. Now, what happened interesting Friday night was the director of National Intelligence, James Clapper's office, kind of threw themselves under the bus, said it was our fault. We misled the White House. We thought it was the video that caused it, that there wasn't no terrorist attack in the first 24 hours. We're the ones who told them that. But we haven't had a chance to question, and Congress has not had a chance to question James Clapper, the director of National Intelligence. He actually, by the way, didn't put out the statement. It was put out under the name of his press secretary. And we haven't had a chance to question the White House about it. This story, the Libya story, is ongoing, and it does undercut, you know, the president has had some strength, and surprising strength for a Democrat, on questions of foreign policy and national security, and they like to brag that they killed Osama bin Laden. They have some questions to answer about how this happened.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Marty next in Bennett. Hi, Marty.
Hi, good morning. I don't hear any of the candidates talking about guns. Once again, last week, a man goes to work, guns down five coworkers, murders them, and it barely makes it through 24 hours in the news, and yet every day for a week last week, we're agonizing over what happened to the Packers. Obama and Romney really need to come forward and start talking about access to weapons of mass murder in this country.
Stephen.
Well, they're not going to. The White House was asked a lot about this after the shooting at the movie theater in Aurora, Colorado, and they were very clear that they're not going to talk about it. And now we can speculate on the reason they wouldn't admit it, but the reason is political. Democrats have lost ground when they've started talking about gun control, and they're not going to do it.
It is interesting that that was a major story, and I think about a time that I was in Belfast some years ago, and the BBC was saying it had to be three or more people to make it a front page story or a top of the news story for the BBC. It seems as though we've reached that point and then some in this country, because that's a big story. Five people were killed, and it didn't make the kind of news that you would expect that it would have.
Yeah, I you know, I remember I watched it a little bit myself because I used to live in Minnesota and
yes.
In Minneapolis, but I can't tell you with any certainty where it was, for instance, on the evening news, whether it was not mentioned at all or whether it was a second. I don't know what else was happening that day. You know, I know the Libya story continues to be a significant story in the attention of the news media, and then the domestic political campaign, so I'm not sure how much coverage it got relative to those.
One more phone call for you, and then we change guests. Still continue with all things political. Fred and Waters Meet. Hi, Fred.
Hi. I want Stephen's view on, I think, where the Republicans made a mistake. And I just was wondering, what would happen if they would have had Karl Rove be Romney's campaign manager instead of having him head this super PAC? Would Romney be ahead then?
Well, that's a fascinating question, because I got to tell you, I'm one of the people who follows this game who thinks Karl Rove is probably the smartest person I've seen come along in managing campaigns in 20 or 30 years. And I think he does a smart job over at his super PAC, where he raises and spends money independently of the campaign. But I think you'd also have to compare Mitt Romney to George W. Bush as a candidate. And you have to compare the time. So I'm not sure Karl Rove would make ultimately a big difference in how Mitt Romney was doing. They don't get to run against Al Gore. They're running against Barack Obama. Those things are different. The economy is different. But I do think Rove is one of the sharpest guys out there in electoral politics.
Thank you, Fred, for your call. Stephen, thank you. I imagine you're going to be a pretty busy man the next couple weeks.
A busy 5 weeks coming up.
Yes. Thank you very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Stephen Toma, senior White House correspondent and the government and politics editor for McClatchy Newspapers, our guest for the first half hour of All Things Political. We continue our conversation. Jeffrey Lord is joining us now on the Ideas Network. He is contributing editor of the American Spectator. Has a very interesting political past. He was Reagan White House political director, and he was an aide to Jack Kemp. Our phone number continues, and our lines are open for you right now, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@WPR.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. I guess as we are 2 days away from the first presidential debate, 50 million of us will be watching. Where do you think each candidate is vulnerable, and where is each candidate strong? We welcome your phone calls as we continue All Things Political with Jeffrey Lord. Hello, Jeffrey.
Good morning there, Kathleen. How are we out there?
Well, we are okay. It's a beautiful day. How are you?
Exactly. And here as well. Here as well. A nice, crisp fall day.
Yes.
Reminds me of my New England youth, and I love it.
Here it is on the first Monday in October, too, is the Supreme Court.
That is right. I guess we'll meet. The Supreme Court comes in today.
Yes, they do. Yes, they do. Let's look at you, because you've had such an interesting political past here, Jeffrey. Tell me about the presidential debates that you thought may have been game changers, and I'm wondering if one of the Ronald Reagan debates was, and which ones you found just absolutely riveting historically.
Yeah, I'll tell you, the very first one, and I hate to confess this, but I remember seeing it as a child, was the Kennedy-Nixon debate.
Mm-hmm.
And by the time I got to college, this had become such a legend that my government professor would always open the freshman year government classes by having the class watch the first or listen to the first 15 minutes of the debate on just the audio. Then he would play the whole thing with the videotape of the Kennedy-Nixon debate. And, of course, then the lesson was that the audience in real time in 1960 that listened to it on the radio thought that Nixon won the debate. The audience that watched it on television thought Kennedy had won the debate. And, of course, it changed the course of history here, because shortly after that, JFK became what he's been ever since, you know, a sort of a rock star of presidents. And they had his crowds suddenly, you know, became huge. And his staff used to call the people in the audience in the crowds the screamers and the jumpers.
Hmm.
So it was quite a transformation, and it was very clear that the, you know, Kennedy had won that, and the television played a real role in it. I think the next one after that was the Ford-Carter debate, in which, of course, there were no debates in 1964 or 1968, for that matter. So we got to 1976, or 1972, so we got to 1976, and President Ford stumbled. And, of course, he made the argument that President Obama will be making tonight, that all incumbent presidents make, that, you know, well, I've got this heavy burden and my opponent is not the president. He just doesn't get it. And so as Ford was making this argument, Carter challenged him on a point of foreign policy. And Ford said, well, I don't believe the Poles consider themselves under Soviet domination. Well, when the camera panned to Carter, who looked down and smiled and was making a note, and you knew right away, I mean, this is a dopey thing for an incumbent president of the United States to be saying in 1976. And sure enough, I think that helped sink his campaign. And you got to 1980, and there was only one debate between the two major candidates. And then Governor Reagan blew Carter away, I think, with a line of, you know, well, there you go again.
Mm-hmm.
And are you better off now than you were 4 years ago? And that sort of solidified it. And, you know, it's very interesting. We talk about these polls all the time. And the polls in 1980, I went back through the New York Times CBS polls, and they consistently said, oh, this race is just close. It's the horse race. It's going to be like 1960. Well, of course, shortly after that debate, and the debate was at the very end of October, about a week or so before the election, you know, Ronald Reagan won in a 44-state landslide. So they can have an impact. There's no doubt about it. And then, of course, in 1984, President Reagan stumbled in that first debate with Walter Mondale, and the story on the inside there was that he'd just been overbriefed. Mrs. Reagan was was furious about this. They were trying to get him to remember every fact and figure and all this kind of thing, and he didn't do very well with it. So the next time around, I believe it was Roger Ailes, now the head of Fox, who stepped in and said, you know, Mr. President, you've had long experience doing this. You've debated a lot. Just concentrate on your themes. And you know, in terms of the age issue, which is, of course, what arose instantly, Reagan himself had the line for that. And so when he was asked by a reporter on the panel about his age, et cetera, Reagan, you know, looked straight-faced into the camera and said, I refuse to make the youth and inexperience of my opponent an issue.
Right,
in this
I remember that.
And the camera
Masterful.
Caught Walter Mondale himself
right.
laughing hysterically
right.
at this. And he knew, I think he said later, that he knew right then and there it was over.
Mm-hmm. Well, he
so
was...
So they can be very important. I mean, you get to Michael Dukakis and the... Bernard Shaw, I think it was, of CNN, asked him, you know, Governor, if your wife were raped, you're opposed to the death penalty, if your wife were raped and murdered, what would you do? And he answered in this very cool, calm fashion, you know, not no passion to it, et cetera. And people later thought that was an incident where, you know, if he had sort of, you know, showed some real passion about it, that he might have changed the debate a little bit. So
yeah.
they have their moments.
I think about this likability factor, Jeffrey, when I think about Ronald Reagan, that he knew how to, he really did know how to communicate to people. And I think of my Uncle Dan O'Leary, who kind of looked like Reagan and was a conductor on the Chicago Northwestern Railway and could spin a story and had that sort of Irish twinkle in his eyes. That,
right.
And I think Reagan had that as well, which brings to mind this likability factor that Mitt Romney evidently has some problems with. People, the electorate is not very fond of him. What do you think is his task in the debates to make himself more likable? Can you do that with just about 5 weeks left until the election? And where are his problems in this whole area of being liked?
You know, frankly, I think it's a mistake for him to try to do it. I've met him once or twice. You know, he's a thoroughly nice man, all of that sort of thing. But your point is well taken. And I think it is a mistake, particularly considering the issues on at play with the economy and now with foreign policy and Libya and all this kind of thing. What he has to do, in my opinion, is show that he is, you know, he's serious, that he will take the country in a different direction, and that he's a no-nonsense guy, and, you know, that we're in deep trouble here, and we need to move in a different direction. If you try and pretend you are something that you are not, that's a mistake, and I don't care. I don't care who you are. You don't even have to be running for president to do that. And I think if he goes in that direction, you know, I knew they did some of this at the convention, and some of this is necessary, I suppose, to get people acclimated to a new possible president. But I think it's a mistake. I mean, President Obama comes across as a likable guy, even with people who disagree with him. But I think that's just not the way to go about it. I mean, he should, you know, be very tough and challenge him on his record and stick to that, and don't get off into these sort of ephemeral things here that you know, in this particular case would not come up as a Romney victory necessarily.
Do you believe the polls at this point, Jeffrey?
No, I don't, because, again, as I say, I went back and took a careful look at these 1980 polls, and it was the same sort of thing. And I think that they're, you know, in listening to pollsters discuss this, what a lot of these polls are doing is using the 2008 results as a baseline to do the sampling. And, you know, we'll never have, well, as with anything else, we'll never have 2008 again. And, you know, there was a huge turnout there. I mean, Barack Obama was new. He was interesting. He could be, at that point, the first African-American president.
Yes.
There was a lot of enthusiasm, all that kind of thing. All of that is gone with the wind. He's been president for 4 years. There's results out there. And so, you know, you're going to – it's just not the same. The turnout isn't going to be the same under any circumstances. I mean, you can't replicate that. So I think – that it's a mistake to look at these polls. He may well be ahead here or there, There's no doubt about that. I'm not really challenging that. But certainly I've learned in the past that it is a huge mistake to make judgment calls on this. And I remember when President George H.W. Bush was behind Michael Dukakis by 17 points as we went into the September campaign. I mean, it was a huge deficit. Ditto with Gerald Ford and Jimmy Carter. Now, Gerald Ford lost, but, you know, everybody was up until, I think, 5 in the morning. It was very close until, I think, it was Mississippi that put Jimmy Carter over. So it's a big mistake, and who knows what can happen in 5 weeks, mm-hmm. anything.
Jeffrey Lord, our guest this part of the show, contributing editor of the American Spectator. He's a former Reagan White House political director and an aide to Jack Kemp. We'll be welcoming phone calls for him now. A couple lines are open if you'd like to join us. 800-486-8655 is our number. The email is talk@WPR.org, or you can always go to our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and leave your message there. We'll check all of those forms of communication and get your comments on the air momentarily. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour two of our program, appropriately on the first Monday in October, Jeffrey Toobin will be with us. Jeffrey has a new book, The Oath, The Obama White House and the Supreme Court, with fascinating information on the characters, personalities of each member, former and some retired, like Sandra Day O'Connor, members of the court. Very interesting information on the Chief Justice, John Roberts, and his relationship with the president. And fresh in our mind, the vote on health care and why Roberts went the way that he did and why he went out of the country for the next 2 weeks to an impregnable fortress, he says, in Malta, which is interesting. So we'll be talking, lots of information about Citizens United, and the workings of the court. And also, because they're starting a new session today, we'll look at some of the big cases that they will be deliberating on during the course of this year. All right, two phone calls, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, talk@WPR.org. Jeffrey Lord, contributing editor of the American Spectator, is our guest this half hour. Kim in Hammond is our next caller. Hi, Kim.
Hi.
Hi.
I was wondering, with the Libya issue, they keep on bringing up Obama's cabinet and how they kept on talking about the fact that they were calling it the fault of the movie. And why is nobody bringing up the fact that Obama was calling it the movie or the trailer up to 2 weeks afterwards? And people aren't even talking about that. I mean, was he even informed? That's my question.
Jeffrey.
I actually think that is being brought up. And there was a call I noticed today, yet again, for the resignation of Ambassador Susan Rice, who was on, I think it was the Fox News Sunday, insisting that this was all about a video. I mean, at this point, and I wrote about this myself, at this point, I don't think anybody in America believes that this video caused all this. I mean, after all, we've had plenty of terrorist attacks in the last 20 or 30 years, long before this video ever got made. So I don't think anybody believes it. And the question is, what really happened here? CNN, of course, has the ambassador's journal, and it indicates that he himself was concerned that he might be a target for assassination there. So I have to believe that Governor Romney is going to bring this up in this debate. And I, Kathleen, frankly, I haven't checked, but I'm guessing that these debates are segmented. In other words, the first is about the domestic policy, and the second foreign policy, et cetera, and the third is a town hall meeting. That's generally the way they do these.
Yes.
However, you know, when you have something like this that sort of dominates the news, I'm guessing that somewhere in there, Governor Romney will, domestic format or not, bring it up. Because it has become an issue here, and it's an issue that I think a lot of people think the president is vulnerable on.
Mm-hmm. Jane writes in an email, I would like for someone to ask Romney and Ryan what they will do for the family working several low-paying service jobs with no insurance. How does a family get out of poverty?
Well, you know, I suspect this answer is not going to be a popular one. It's two things. Of course, it's lowering taxes, but it's also cutting the budget. I mean, this is what Ronald Reagan went through this almost exactly. And I certainly well remember that after he took office, you know, with unemployment was continuing to skyrocket. It finally reached 9.6%. Inflation was up to 13 some odd percent, and the interest rates were 21%. President Reagan, along with the chairman of the Fed at the time, Paul Volcker, really put the squeeze on the economy and to get the money out of the, you know, extra printed money out of the system and all this kind of thing. Well, of course, this caused the unemployment rate to go up even more, et cetera. There were hard times there for a couple of years, but it had to be done to squeeze all this stuff out of the system. And sure enough, by 1984, when he was running for re-election, the inflation rate had dropped tremendously. I think it was down around 4%. The interest rates had really come down, and unemployment was on its way down. It was back around 7-some-odd percent and kept going down, you know, while he was president until it got to be, I think, 5.4% when he left office. So the answer here is there are going to be tough times here, but you've got to make the economy work as a whole. And you have to stop all this government spending, or what's going to happen is we will wind up like Greece or Spain, or, you know, these countries where people are just, you know, going crazy in the streets because of austerity. I mean, we're going to have some austerity as it is, but we also have to have economic growth. Those are the answers. I mean, the only way that people get paid in these lower ranking jobs, as they were, and they don't have to stay there forever. But the only way they're going to get paid is if other people have the money to pay them, to buy their products, to use their services. So that money has to be put back in the system.
Jim in Black River Falls, hi.
Hi. I was curious. I agree with your guest there. I don't believe the polls either. I think these polls are way off. But how can President Obama possibly defend himself on his record domestically and international? And it's looks to me like Romney has a lot of material there to work with. Obama, on the other hand, taxes and all that, I just don't see how that's going to have any effect in the debate when it hasn't had any effect in the polls. I just want to know his comment on that.
All right. Thank you, yeah. Jim.
I would have to agree with you. It's very hard for an incumbent president, and it isn't just Barack Obama. I mean, when you think back to Jimmy Carter in 1980 or George H.W. Bush in 1992, or God bless him, Herbert Hoover back in 1932, it is extremely hard for an incumbent president who has a high unemployment rate and all these economic woes going on to defend their record. And the opponent, whomever that might be, whether it's Bill Clinton or Ronald Reagan, will pounce on this, you know, instantly and repeatedly. And the thing where this resonates is, you know, this is not an academic debate in terms of regular folks. I mean, everybody is going to the gas station, and the price of gas is up, and it's costing more to fill their tank. If the price of groceries is going up, that's going to be reflected. I mean, this really hits home. So as they listen to these two people debate, they're going to be thinking, what's going on in my life every day? You know, do I have a job, and do I have to hustle over to the unemployment office, that kind of thing. So it does have real resonance, and that's going to be a problem for the president.
And what about the problem that Governor Romney faces, that he just doesn't seem to be able to connect with those regular folks, that he has perhaps, you could say, an economic problem of his own in that he is in that way upper 1%, and it's just a different world that voters can't connect with, Jeffrey?
Right. I think he's not done as good a job as he can with this. I mean, because very frankly, we've had wealthy Democrats. I also worked early in my life for the late Senator John Hines. And if your audience remembers, he was killed in a plane crash, and his widow, Teresa, married John Kerry, Senator
yes.
Kerry. Well, through his marriage to Teresa Hines, when John Kerry ran for president, he was worth about $600 million, which frankly is more money than Mitt Romney has. And, you know, he lost by 100,000 votes, and nowhere in there did I hear, we can't elect this guy because he's got too much money.
But he may have had the same problem, don't you think, that he was criticized, too, for being too much upper crust and not able to connect with the average person?
I mean, both
John Kerry.
Bush was wealthy. Bush was wealthy as well, although not that wealthy. But I my point is, I don't think it was. It wasn't raised as much of a problem for him. The problem for Romney is that he, you know, he's the quote unquote self-made man here, even though he came from a well-to-do father. You know, he did this whole fortune thing on his own, and he seems to be reticent, as some wealthy people are, in defending this. And I would say that is a problem for him.
Mm-hmm.
It shouldn't be. I mean, because I think if you're on the ball here with this stuff, you should make an aggressive defense of the capitalistic system. But, you know, that it seems to be difficult for him to do. So I do think that that can be a problem.
Lynn in Eau Claire, hi.
Hi, Kathleen and Jeffrey. I was wondering about the negative political atmosphere in states like Wisconsin and Arizona and all the divisiveness. How would your guest see that affecting the presidential election?
Well, it does. And I'd make two points. You know, the business about divisiveness, I mean, when you read American history, this has gone on forever in a day. It's never new. It goes on everywhere in every year. Some years are better or worse than others. In terms of places like Wisconsin or Arizona, what it can do is to use in the vernacular, it can gin up the base. In other words, if you've got people who are really passionate about, and you guys are from Wisconsin, I am not, so I'm just talking about Wisconsin here as your basic television viewer. But certainly it seemed to me that the recall episode there with Governor Walker, you know, really brought people out in droves on both sides, and Governor Walker, you know, carried the day there. It would seem to me logically to think, particularly with Paul Ryan on the ticket, that a lot of those people who voted for Governor Walker are still pretty ginned up about this issue in general and prepared to vote for Governor Romney. Ditto on a state-by-state basis if there's anything, you know, that really concerns people in a certain state that they really identify with either Governor Romney or President Obama, that they would go out of their way to go to the polls and vote. So the divisiveness, I think, is normal. The question is, you know, does it really wind people up to go out there in droves and vote? And I think, you know, in a lot of cases, the answer is yes.
Let's talk for a moment about Jack Kemp. You were an aide to Jack Kemp, and Paul Ryan worked for him, and Kemp was a mentor to him in many ways. Are those two similar? If we look at Kemp, what do we learn about Ryan?
If you look at Kemp, what you learn about Paul Ryan is that he is a thoroughgoing believer in economic growth. This was something that Jack, you know, harped on repeatedly. I mean, this was his entire career, and it made a real impact, first of all, with Ronald Reagan, because a lot of people forget this, but when Ronald Reagan challenged Gerald Ford in 1976, he did so, you know, he was the more conservative guy, but it was more along sort of traditional lines. Between 1976 and 1980, he really got close to Jack Kemp, and who had been an intern of his, interestingly enough, in the California governor's office. And it was Jack Kemp who introduced him to what we call today supply-side economics and all of that kind of thing. This was Jack's signature issue. He sold it to Ronald Reagan. It became the basis of the Reagan recovery in the 1980s. And with Paul Ryan having worked closely with Jack, and I can tell you, having done this, anybody who does this came away with his enthusiasm. And, you know, you really spent time learning, you know, the Austrian economist, you know, Ludwig von Mises and all of that kind of thing, to understand how it worked, how socialist economics does not work, you know, this kind of thing. So Paul Ryan would I'm sure at this point this is in his bones.
One more phone call for you, John in Waukesha. Hi, John.
Hi. I wonder what the guest take is on my point that I think a lot of people are starting to really realize that there's been a conspiracy against this president. I mean, you know, you have Mitch McConnell, majority leader in the Senate, admitting that, you know, first priority was to stop this president, you know, and that everything from that to the lies that you've had Ryan busted out on PolitiFact every night when he was on the convention. You know, the lies about everything from small stuff to the GM plant closing has been debunked.
All right. I need to hold you there, John. We're almost out of time. Jeffrey.
Well, first of all, I would disagree here that there's any kind of conspiracy. Every 4 years, the opposition, the losing opposition, tries to get the new president out of office. I mean, this went on with Ronald Reagan. It went on with George W. Bush, George H.W. Bush, Bill Clinton, et cetera. So President Obama is just another president in that sense, at least as far as I can see. The GM plant, very quickly, I followed through on that, and Paul Ryan was correct. It did close down to a certain extent in the December of 2008, but it didn't close finally. And as I understand it, it is listed by GM as idling or idle at the moment. It is not finally closed. And concerning President Obama's promise as a candidate that the plant would get, you know, reopened and live for 100 years, I mean, it simply hasn't happened.
Jeffrey,
I don't think there's any conspiracy. Okay.
We're out of time. Thank you, sir, very much. Always enjoy having you on the show.
Thanks a lot, Kathleen.
Jeffrey Lord, contributing editor of the American Spectator, former Reagan White House political director and aide to Jack Kemp. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning and Brett Jaspers, who produced this program. Thanks, everybody, for all of your calls. A reminder that we will be carrying the first presidential debate this coming Wednesday evening. Stay with us because there will be a lot of political discussions, of course, ahead.